listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, quick tip, the Campaign for America's Future has got a gig coming up in November. You can find out about it over on their website, Celebrating America's Future, the 2013 Gala Awards with special guest Elizabeth Warren. So this should be fun. It's at ourfuture.org is their website. Egypt is continuing to be in a state of crisis. And in fact, that is clearly one of the biggest stories of the day. So let's start there. Rebecca Abushadid is with us. She's a Truman Fellow and chair with the Middle East and North Africa expert group at the Truman National Security Project. TrumanProject.org is the website. Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, your assessment or your kind of headlines at the top of the news of what's going on in Egypt right now.
It's really heartbreaking to watch. We're so far from, the hopes of the millions of Egyptians that came into Tahrir Square all what feels like so long ago in the original revolution. And the thing that really worries me about what you're seeing in Egypt is the short-term implications are dire. But also, what you're seeing is not just a failure of the state, but a dissolution of the nation. And so, what you're hearing from both sides is this can only happen in a context where each side has started to really dehumanize and delegitimize the other. And so, you're hearing a lot of rhetoric about these people, whoever the other side is, not really being Egyptian and not somehow being authentic in expressing their kind of Egyptianhood. And that's what really kind of disturbs me and bothers me more than anything, to see this kind of violence and for pro-revolutionary, Morsi was an awful president, but to see people be able to kind of stomach this amount of violence and death against their fellow Egyptians and be able to somehow find ways to excuse it, and then for Morsi and Brotherhood supporters to be able to kind of use the rhetoric and excuse violence against. There are now attacks on 56 Coptic churches and bookstores and other institutions throughout the country.
Right.
It's really, to me, very worrying. And
we heard this.
It's what we've seen in Iraq. It's what we've seen in Syria. It's what we've seen in Lebanon.
Yeah.
And I can't believe I'm seeing it in Egypt.
And it's what we saw in the United States in the 1850s. I mean, this is the run-up to civil war, typically, when two factions within a country, major factions, begin objectifying the other.
That's right.
The history of American involvement with Egypt goes way back, and right now, I think our current. And by the way, I should mention you've been to Egypt many times. You were in Cairo the day of Morsi's constitutional decree for the Truman Research Project. You were an election monitor for the NDI for the first round of Egypt's parliamentary elections. So you have a pretty good insight into this. We, last year, I believe it was, gave them $1.3 billion in military aid and about $250 million, about $0.2 billion, almost three-tenths of $1 billion in so-called non-military aid.
Right.
And my understanding is that the vast majority of that $1.3 billion that we, quote, gave them in military aid, end quote, none of that money actually ever left the United States. It went from a checking account for the U.S. government to checking accounts for Lockheed Martin and GE Aviation on and on the list goes, for tanks, for electronics, for F-16s, whatever the planes are, for Black Hawk helicopters. And that a lot of the so-called civilian aid is actually going, the military in Egypt owns so much of the country's industrial infrastructure that pretty much anything that's manufactured there is ultimately manufactured by the military. So it's making many senior military folks into multimillionaires. Is that an accurate, first of all, assessment?
Well, particularly the first part, the description of how U.S. military aid works, it's not unique to Egypt. It's pretty much how our military aid works to most countries, maybe only with the exception of Israel, is that we give nations military aid so that we're basically giving them money to buy our stuff. So you're right that it's not really about aid to that country specifically.
And we don't even cycle it through their checking accounts so that their banks can make a profit off it. We run it through our own, you know, Bank of America handles it or whatever.
Right. It's pretty clear kind of what's going on. And I think you can see, you know, without saying kind of why that creates a problem, particularly in our relationship, not so much with the militaries of those countries, but actually with the people of those countries.
Right. The bullets are made in the USA. The bombs are made in the USA. The tear gas canisters literally have made in USA printed on them, the tanks, the helicopters, the guns.
And not just that. Look, many, you know, a lot of Arab countries have respect for their military. So it's not just that we're supplying militaries that bothers them, but the idea is that where we put our priority, where we see that the importance of a relationship is with either the you know, like one, like a strong man Arab leader or the military, and not in actually investing in the people of the region.
Right. If we had put $1 billion into building schools, particularly schools for girls, if we had put $500 million into, or $1 billion into building a year over the last 30 years, into building hospitals, into building infrastructure, you know, good electric grids, good septic systems, good water systems, good roads, the kind of infrastructure on which business grows so that domestic industry could blossom, we would be in a very different place right now, would we not? And so would Egypt.
I think we would. You know, I don't want to cut, you know, so I have so many friends who work in, you know, for USAID, and these people are doing amazing work, and really I think that we undervalue the work that they do.
But they're doing it at a fraction of this budget.
Right. And so many Americans, you know, if you ask them what percentage of our budget goes to foreign aid, they'll think that it's, you know, 10 or 15%, and it's so minuscule. But but really it's about, you know, our budget reflects our priorities in everything that we do. So not just foreign aid, but the way that we spend money here at home. And people understand that, and they understand kind of where the interest is. And so I think, you know, I've spent a lot of my life in the Arab world, and there's always kind of a disappointment in the United States in the sense that, you know, most Arabs want what the United States has, in the sense of you can get a job, you can go to school, you can have a better life than your parents had. And they've always kind of looked up to, but also been disappointed, I think, by U.S. foreign policy that doesn't really look at them or see them.
Right. All they get are tanks. They don't get schools. They don't get good jobs. They don't get an economy that is diverse and potentially self-sufficient.
And I think that there's a feeling, I mean, in Egypt right now, you know, there's a lot of anger at the United States. I think some of it's unfair, quite frankly. I think some of it is that the Egyptian people are going through a process that they're going to have to decide what the future of Egypt is. And so I do think that sometimes there's an unfair kind of omnipotence given to the United States that we are this kind of invisible hand all over the region. And I don't agree with that. But I do think that we've been too reactive. We haven't been very clear. It's true that all foreign policy is a balance between interests and values. But we need to be very clear about where our values are, and at many times we haven't. And we also need to kind of, I think in the U.S. discourse about what's going on in the Middle East, step away a bit from the fetishization of elections alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, elections are something you can see. You see the purple finger,
right.
you see people waiting in line, you could talk to them. I understand why elections are as important as they are, but an election alone is not democracy.
Yeah.
And we really have to kind of be looking at that whole picture.
Brilliant. Rebecca, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You can Rebecca Abou-Shadid, you can read her writings over at TrumanProject.org. And this is a complex issue.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That is not going to be resolved today or tomorrow or any day this week. And something that should be causing America to be seriously thinking about the way we're doing this. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. I want to get into tipping in a second, which is a very different topic than talking about Egypt. But first, I want to finish up this Egypt thing or a discussion of the Egypt situation. I started to touch on my take on this, but I really wanted to hear Rebecca's before I went off on mine. Here's what's recently happened in Egypt in a different frame than you've been getting in the media. The military, of course, is the most powerful force in Egypt because, as Rebecca pointed out, our priorities are always to make the military very powerful because there's a lot of money to be made. The $1 billion plus every year that we send to Egypt, we don't actually send to Egypt. We send it to Raytheon and Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Halliburton and on and on. And they make things that end up in Egypt. But the money doesn't go to Egypt and then come back here to buy things. The money just goes to the, you know, our aid is shipped to them in the form of goods that are manufactured here in the United States. And we have become addicted to Egypt's foreign aid. Because all of those companies have big lobbies. This is one of the reasons you're never going to see a cut in our foreign aid. Not that there should be. I mean, if our foreign aid is, you know, less than 1% of our budget, or in the neighborhood of 1% of our budget, our discretionary budget, which is like meaningless in terms of, you know, budgetary significance or anything else. But the tragic reality is that the vast majority of our military aid is foreign aid is military, and as military stuff, it takes the form of things that we make here that are designed to blow things up and kill people, and then we ship overseas. So we have, you know, this huge industry in the United States that does just that. They make things that blow things up and kill people, period. And this is not, you know, this is no way to run an economy. It's no way to run a government. The people of Egypt would like to have an economy like ours, but we're not giving that to them. Instead, we're giving them tanks. I mean, just compare this with the Marshall Plan. After World War II, Europe was in ashes. It was in flames. They were having cholera epidemics in Germany. After World War II, Japan was in flames. Did we say, oh, we'll make cars and sell them to you? We'll make clothes and sell them to you? We'll make cement and ship it to you? We'll make a new military for you and ship it to you? No, we did not. Now, that's how, you know, that's the kind of foreign aid that we're doing now. Our foreign aid has turned into a welfare program for domestic American corporations or transnational corporations that have large presences here in the United States, in most cases started as American corporations. But back during the Marshall Plan era, what we did was we said, here's some money for you to bootstart your own domestic industries. This was the debate I got in with the caller yesterday who said, oh, well, the reason the economy was so good in the 50s, 60s, and 70s was because the rest of the world was in flames and we didn't have any competitors for our manufactured goods. Well, sort of, but that really was not why the United States did so well in the 50s, 60s, and 70s and 80s, early 80s anyway. The reason why we did is because we had, you know, we had a rational trade policy and we had a strong unionization. The same reason that Sweden's economy is still doing well, that Germany's economy is still doing well, that Finland and Denmark and Norway, that their economies are still doing well, you know, what, 70, 80 years after World War II. So how did our Marshall Aid work, our Marshall Plan aid work? We gave them some money and we loaned them some money. And we said, okay, build your own cement factories, build your own asphalt plants. Build your own highways. Build your own cars. Build your own military. Build your own weapons. Build your own hospitals. Build your own schools. You do that. We rebooted their industry. And now they have, you know, modern 21st century economies. That is not how we do foreign aid now. The way we do foreign aid now is we say, hey, you want some weapons? Here you go. We will pretend we gave you $1 billion, but we're actually going to give it to Lockheed Martin. Because you don't have lobbyists in Washington, D.C., but Lockheed Martin does. And interestingly, I mean, I remember Rebecca said the only country that's the exception to this is Israel. And I would say, no, not actually, because after the Camp David agreements, we basically cut this bribe with Egypt, where for every $3 Israel gets, Egypt gets $1.50. And whatever the percentage of military to domestic is that we give to Israel, we give the same to Egypt. And in 2011, it was $1.3 billion in military aid. In and a quarter of $1 billion in non-military aid, which was almost all went to the military in Egypt because they control everything. They make everything. So anyhow, you've got the military in charge of Egypt, right? They've taken over the country. We set this up 50 years ago. They run the country. They own most of the industry. They are the oligarchs. The oligarchs of Egypt are the military. And the military contractors, who, by the way, happen to be members of the military. It's just like in the United States, except here we make this very small step of somebody becomes an executive at Boeing after they retire from the military rather than at the same time. In Egypt, they do it at the same time. That's the only difference. And militaries do what? They kill people and they blow up things. They blow up things and they kill people. That's what they do. That's what they do. So you've got these protests against Morsi being booted out, and the military's in charge. What does the military do? Well, they only know how to do one thing. Abe Maslow said, the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. The only tool that the Egyptian government has is its military. That is the government. And so they've got this problem of people protesting that that the elected guy has been deposed, so what do? They hit it with the hammer that they've got. They hit that problem, that nail, with the hammer that they have, which is, killing people and blowing things up. And surprise, surprise, the Egyptian people are not all that pleased about it. So, anyhow, I wanted to share that with you. I also would like to... Do you think that restaurants should end the practice of tipping? Let me get into that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This is actually a serious topic. There's starting to be a debate, and it has to do with the entry level to the middle class, because increasingly we're a service economy. Lots of people work in restaurants. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, so there's this restaurant. There's actually a couple of them. This is happening... Here we go. Jay Porter, the founder of Linkery, previously of San Diego, currently close to move to San Francisco, eliminated tipping in that restaurant's second year. Instead, he put an 18% surcharge and just, everybody gets the tip. So that's one way to do it. Another is other restaurants are simply saying, instead of paying our wait staff $3 an hour plus tips, we're going to pay them, $15 an hour plus benefits, period. And just say no tipping. Another option, which I don't see anybody discussing in the United States, but it's kind of a middle ground, is to say you can tip, but you can't tip over 10%. So it's kind of the European model. In fact, Europeans are the bane of the existence. First time European tourists to the United States are the bane of the lives of people who work at restaurants on the East Coast. Well, all over the country, presumably, but I know in particular on the East Coast, on the West Coast, where tourists just suddenly pop up from Germany or France and they tip 5% and think that they're really, really doing good, right? 10%? Wow! I mean, when you're in Europe, in many of these countries, in many of these places, you kind of basically tip with pocket change. Because the person is already making a decent wage. In fact, if you don't get really superlative service, don't tip at all. Nobody's offended. Well, maybe a little bit. But the point is that tipping is that for waitstaffs, this is kind of the last of the meritocracies in the United States. Or the last place, one of the few places where consumers have a direct interface and are able to, with people who are providing services and are able to respond to that in a way that is calibrated to the quality of service they got. Go to a McDonald's, you don't tip the person at McDonald's. If you go into a department store or go to Walmart, buy something, somebody helps you out, you don't tip them. But taxis and even that, Uber now doesn't take tips. You can't tip an Uber driver. Instead, what happens, Uber is the service that is giving the taxis a run for their money big time here in Washington, D.C., where limousine drivers in their spare time will pick you up. It's a whole computer you know, runs on an iPhone kind of thing. And it's all computerized. It's super efficient. And basically, for the cost of a cab ride, a little bit more. Now they've got Uber X, which is actually the cost of a cab ride a little bit less. Again, no tips. They will take you anywhere you want to go. And they do it in nice, clean, brand new, freshly, you know, spiffy cars and nice drivers. And it's really pretty cool. But you still, it's still a meritocracy, because when you get out, before you can order the next car on the app, you are required to rate that driver 1 to 5 stars. And if the driver's, if their number of stars starts dropping below a certain threshold, I'm not sure what it is. I've heard that it's 4.5, but I or 4. I'm not really, I don't know. Nobody at Uber's ever explicitly told me. I've had drivers tell me that. But if they fall below that number, they lose their job. They lose their gig with Uber. And on the other hand, when you get out of the car, they rate you. So, you know, if you show up at 2 o'clock in the morning drunk out of your mind and pee all over the back seat of their car, and that, by the way, this is the kind of stuff that happens relatively commonly in taxis. People throw up in them, you know, et cetera. They rate you 1 star, and you get rated badly a couple of times, and they just won't take your business anymore, the company. So there is something to be said for some sort of a meritocratic system in the service industry. But this whole let's pay restaurant workers lousy wages, you know, the minimum wage is suspended for restaurant workers in most places. Or Portland, Oregon, where I used to live just recently, I mean, just in the last couple of years when I was living there, said, okay, we're going to do away with this. You have to pay restaurant workers minimum wage, which is $8 and something in Portland. And you can tip them. And all the restaurants were like, this is going to be the end of the world, but it wasn't. So this is not just, you know, kind of small talk stuff. This has to do with the one of the largest and one of the only growing industries in the United States. Meanwhile, I don't know if you caught this, Daniel Gross writing over at the Daily Beast. Walmart's same-store sales are falling. They're making less money. Why? Well, he says this isn't complicated. By paying low wages, Walmart's effectively limiting the ability of a large chunk of the American workforce to consume. They're the largest employer in America. And by setting a low benchmark, they encourage other employers to do the same. So people who work at Walmart or who work at companies whose pay scales are influenced by Walmart can't afford to buy more stuff. And so guess what? Their sales start going down. It's like it's the down-the-drain cycle. So anyhow, some of my thoughts, and let's pick up some of your calls here and see what you have to say. It's anything goes summer anyway. Larry in Edmonds, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Yeah, I appreciate your program so much, Tom, and I have one comment, one observation, and that is that the only animal stupid enough to invent war is the Homo sapien.
Well, I think ants do it, but your point is well taken.
Yeah. So, anyway, thanks for your program.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you, Larry. Yeah, this is my point, that war is organized, legalized insanity. And when ants do it, they actually do it for a sane reason. You know, it has to do with, you know, climates moving around and or, you know, people, somebody builds a road and suddenly this ant hill gets displaced and so they got to go to war with another bunch of ants, which is how it works with people, by the way. You go back and you look at all the old Indian wars. They almost always had to do, the big one was when there was a minor climate change back 600-700 years ago up in the north, and there were droughts and famines in central Canada, what is now central Canada, and Dene people came down into the center of what is now the United States, and they became the Apaches and the Lakota Sioux, I believe. And they invaded the areas that were occupied by the Pueblo people, the Hopi and whatnot, and boom, conflict. But it was conflict driven by climate change. Anyhow, by change in environments. Michael in Fresh Meadows, New York, listening to WWRL. What's up, Michael?
Hi, Tom. I enjoy listening to you.
Thank you.
And I've been listening to you for a long time. And I'd like to ask you, with all the money that we give to Egypt military, you don't think it's possible that our government knew that they were going to take off President Morsi, person who was legitimately elected by the people 53 million vote?
I don't know. I don't claim to have that level of foreign policy or espionage expertise. It wouldn't surprise. I mean, I'd be frankly astounded if our government didn't have a very strong inkling of which way the wind was blowing in Egypt. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, we've been surprised and bamboozled a number of times in areas and ways that we didn't expect. So I just don't know.
Please keep up the good work.
Okay. Thank you.
Program and radio, and we appreciate you.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you for your kind words. Emily in Ithaca, New York. Hey, Emily. Thanks for listening to KABQ.com. What's up?
Hey. So thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about the tips in restaurants. My husband and I actually own a restaurant in Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
And well, for federally mandated wages being, you know, a living wage, and then if people want a tip on top of that, go ahead. I think it's kind of antiquated to have our employees' wages basically determined by people who are dining in the restaurant. And as like you said, there are a lot of people from other countries, especially here where we are, because we have Cornell as basically our major industry. And so a lot of times if you're working in a restaurant that isn't a high-end place, you are going to get a lot of maybe college students, or just generally the population is going to be very diverse, and people who culturally don't grow up with this tipping culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're making, you know, in many cases less than minimum wage for a very difficult job.
Yeah.
So we just don't think that, I mean, and I was listening when you were talking about the rating customers, and I would be down with that in restaurants as well.
Yeah.
Because if somebody comes in and they're, you know, mean to the employees and, you know, that sort of thing, they should be rated.
Yep. It's like the only way to do it, and then we start getting into privacy issues, but it's sort of like the only way to do it would be to have people pay in advance, or at least put their, you know, like you do when you check into a hotel, you give them your credit card, and or require everybody to be a member of a frequent eater program or something, somehow, some way of identifying somebody when they walk in the door so that you know whether you're going to refuse them service, you know, based on prior behavior.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it would be an interesting experiment, socially speaking, to see it in restaurants or other types of service industry, because it would basically force people to stop being jerks.
Yeah. Is that a big problem as a restaurant owner? Is that a big problem, that people being fool,
you know,
or being bad?
It's not that frequent, but it does happen that wait staff or people who, you know, are in the kitchen or whatever,
right,
might not get treated the best. They just are treated like less than people, and we have very knowledgeable employees. They spent their lives basically learning how to do this job. People who are in their 40s, some of them, and have been doing it since they're 15, so you know, they know a lot.
I got it. Emily, I'm sorry we're out of time, but your point is brilliant. Thank you for the call. Thanks for sharing this with us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, human nature, incentives, not incentives, the service industry, do we all want to feel like kings and queens? What's going on? 10 minutes before the hour, taking back the mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and Andre in Blue Island, Illinois. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, there, Tom. How you feel today?
I'm feeling well. I hope you are, too.
Well, thank you. I am. Well, Tom, what I want to say is that, you know, those public service workers, I never could understand that whole thing. If the law says that you got to pay somebody a minimum wage, why do they allow that restaurant industry to do something like that? Now, I work in public service. What I do here in Illinois is drive a paratransit bus, which pick up the handicapped people and so forth.
Right.
Now, I get paid a wage, but the people are only allowed to carry 3 bags when they use this service. That's the minimum, or no more bags than they can handle. But what happens frequently is these people catch the bus, and they got like 10 or 12 grocery bags, and we have to carry them. So would it be fair that we attach a gratuity to them when they ride? Because I consider myself a public service worker, and I don't get no tip.
Right.
But I'm stepping outside of my job duty when I have to accommodate. To me, that's equivalent to having a table of 30 people there that you got to service.
Sure.
By carrying a grocery bag.
Sure. That's a really interesting question, because, you know, a restaurant worker, with a few exceptions, but generally across the United States, restaurant workers are paid $2 or $3 an hour plus tips. And so, you know, in that context, the people who are eating in the restaurant realize that they are basically the sole source of income for those restaurant workers. And I mean, you know, we being people who eat in restaurants, didn't say, let's set up the system this way. It's just sort of evolved that way over the years. On the other hand, as a bus driver, you're paid a decent salary and decent benefits, I'm hoping. So, but on the other hand, on the third hand, as you correctly point out, when you're asked to do something beyond your job description, you know, if I was showing up with 10 grocery bags and I knew that the limit was 3 and you were kind enough to help me out and say, I'm not going to, you know, just play the old, hey, it's by the book, sorry, buddy, you got to leave 7 bags at the curb and off we go. Instead, you'd help me get them onto the bus or whatever. I would like to be able to give you a tip. I don't think that, and by the way, when I know this for a fact because I've done it a lot of times. I see it all the time. The buses that pick you up at the airport and take you out to the rental car place, those guys, if they carry your bags onto the bus and if they carry your bags off the bus, they typically, a lot of people don't tip them, but a lot of people do tip them. So, I mean, they're not working for the city. They're working for a private corporation, but tipping has moved into that area. So,
right. Well, that's just, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
Well, I was just going to say, you raised an interesting question, Andre. You were going to say?
Yeah, and I've been downtown Chicago and by some of the exclusive motels, and those guys that work, they get paid a wage for working in a motel, but when they come out and carry those people's bags to the room, they get a nice sizable tip, you know, for doing that service. So
yeah.
If the government says that a minimum wage has to be, just for example, $8, then I don't see how a restaurant is able to get away with paying somebody less than that, banking on their tips. If that's the case, that means that the restaurant is not paying the amount of tax that they should be paying.
Yeah, among other things. Yeah, I'm with you. Very interesting. Thank you, Andre. Thanks for the call. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two quick points. One, you mentioned yesterday about the leisure economy. I remember there was an economist I saw 50 years ago on PBS, Robert Baldwin, and he explained this whole thing about the leisure economy, what we were headed to, and that...
What show is that?
You know, I think it was on Buckley, but I just remember the guy's face.
Mm-hmm.
His long hair, but it was Robert Baldwin. I looked him up yesterday after I heard your show. He was on the University of Wisconsin. He just died recently, I think a year or so ago. But I remembered that, and it was such powerful presentation and such an eye-opener.
About how we were all, this was back in the 60s, about how by the year 2000 we'd all be working 30 hours a week and making $90,000 a year.
Yeah, and the economy was going to be a big part of the economy would be for capitalism was for the leisure class. You
right.
know, not the leisure class, I mean, but leisure time.
Right, leisure time for the working class.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I remember
and,
it well.
And what they would tell
that
them.
Was the promise. That and nuclear power is going to make electricity free.
And what I was going to say though about your restaurant
yes,
thing, I was in Ireland. About 20 years ago, early 90s,
mm-hmm.
with some people I worked with, it was a business sort of deal. We went over there, and we found this restaurant that was well-recommended, and they had a daily catch, and they provided a feast. It was sort of like bar food, you know,
mm-hmm.
but it was more extravagant than just, you know, bar food. They prepared this and everything,
right.
and everybody talked about it. So we were over there, and it came time to pay up, and the bartender said, you don't leave any tip. In Ireland,
mm-hmm.
they work for us. If you leave a tip, they consider it an insult.
Yes. I had that experience in Germany, in a little town in Germany when we first moved there in 86, and I left a 20% tip for a waitress, and she came over and brought me back my money and said, this is too much, and she looked insulted, like as if I had just said, you know, oh, you pathetic domestic worker, let me throw some coins your way.
A friend of mine ignored the advice or ignored the explanation.
Right.
And he dropped a big tip. He thought that if you tip big enough, they would all go diving for it.
Right.
You know, they would all, you know, they'd neglect that. And as soon as he did that, the whole atmosphere changed the bar. They looked. They stopped. Everything was taken off the bar. You know, all right, thank you very much. You know, goodbye. You know, out the door. You know, and we're leaving. I realize now that whole evening was ruined by that fact that this guy had to sort of diminish these people
right.
by saying, here. Here's
right, because in a way, leaving a tip is saying, I'm a big shot. I'm the big guy. Here's some pennies dripping off the edge of my table, sort of thing. It's almost like a Reaganomics trickle down.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, this was all business money spending, so it was a write off for him. I mean, he was.
So it didn't even cost him anything. Yeah. I've been there and I've seen that, and it's just and yes. Who does that person work for? Do they work for the restaurant or do they work for you, the customer? And many restaurants are basically saying, no, we're not going to really take responsibility for our employees. We're not going to give them health benefits. We're not going to give them decent pay. We're going to rely on the customers to do that, which is bizarre. Frank, thank you for the call. Thanks for the story. Great story.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. You know, it's easier to abolish women. Seriously. It's easier to abolish women or to send illegal immigrants to the moon than it is to improve our nation, at least according to Republicans. At a town hall meeting this past weekend, Republican Congressman Blake Farenthold of Texas told his constituents that Republicans in the House probably have enough votes to impeach President Obama. Really? He was asked a question about Obama by one of his birther constituents, and he responded to the birther question with, well, you tie into a question I get a lot. If everybody's so unhappy with what the president's done, why don't you impeach him? And I'll give you a real frank answer about that. If we were to impeach the president tomorrow, you could probably get the votes in the House of Representatives to do it. But it would then go to the Senate, and he wouldn't be convicted. End of quote. I mean, Farenthold didn't get into any of the specifics about what the Republicans planned on impeaching President Obama. Four, that's Daryl Issa's job. You know, well, let's see, Benghazi, IRS, so what? Well, what else is there, right? Well, we'll come up with something. You know, this is nuts, right? The idea of these Republicans trying to impeach President Obama with no reason. It's absurd. But Farenthold actually does raise a good question. What else do Republicans probably have enough votes to do? Folks over at Democratic Underground compiled a great tongue-in-cheek list yesterday of other things that House Republicans probably have enough votes to do. DU talks about how Republicans probably have enough votes to rename Washington, D.C. as Reaganville. Hey, live from Reaganville. Every Republican places Reagan on a pedestal. What better way to honor the Gipper than to rename our nation's capital after him? Really, you know? They also probably have enough votes to give full voting rights to fetuses. That might run into a constitutional problem, but they'd try it. And to ensure that every preschool in America is equipped with a gun range. Republicans probably have enough votes to make teaching evolution in our schools illegal. They actually kind of functionally have done that in a few places. And at the same time, they probably have enough votes in the House to amend the Constitution's opening sentence to read, we, the Koch brothers. Finally, Republicans probably have enough votes to abolish women from the United States and to send every last illegal immigrant to the moon in a giant rocket ship. Now, there's a serious side to this. DU made that list to make fun of Farenthold and the Republican wackadoodles in the House. But, you know, given the state of the Republican Party right now, given how genuinely insane these people are, The Republicans in the House of Representatives actually probably, you know, I wouldn't put any of this stuff past them. So what don't House Republicans have enough votes to pass? What is it that they do not have enough votes to pass? Well, for starters, House Republicans don't have enough votes within their own caucus to pass their very own plan for tackling America's health care woes. They voted 40 times to repeal Obamacare. But have they ever introduced their own plan to make health care, you know, just basic, affordable, accessible to Americans? How many times? Zero. Republicans in the House don't have enough votes to pass comprehensive tax reform, something that might make wealthy Americans pay their fair share. Not going to happen. At the same time, they don't have the votes to close the corporate tax loopholes that allow corporations to make billions in profit. Corporate profit right now is higher than it has ever been in the history of the United States, at least as far as we know. And their taxes are the lowest it's ever been. In fact, since Reagan came into the White House, corporate profits have skyrocketed while corporate income taxes have dwindled. For example, B of A, Bank of America, $17.2 billion in profits offshore in 2010. How much did they pay in taxes? Zero. Telecommunications giant Verizon, $19.3 billion in U.S. pre-tax profits from 2008 to 2012. But thanks to corporate tax loopholes, Verizon paid no federal income taxes during that period and instead got $535 million in tax rebates from the government. The chance of House Republicans passing corporate tax reform is about as likely as them passing any sort of comprehensive infrastructure bill. America's roads and bridges are collapsing. Our transportation systems are incredibly outdated. Our electrical grid not only looks like something out of the 19th century, it is out of the 19th century. But despite our nation's crumbling infrastructure, Republicans refuse to invest the money that's needed to move us into the 21st century. Republicans in the House don't have enough votes to make higher education affordable to Americans. Right now, you've got between $900 billion and $1 trillion in outstanding student loan debt in the United States. $864 billion of that is federal student loan debt, which could be easily handled by Congress. These staggering figures are because, according to College Board, the price of attending a public four-year college has risen 27% faster than inflation over the past 5 years. According to Bloomberg, since Reagan came into office, college tuition and fees have increased 1,120%. And finally, House Republicans certainly don't have enough votes to pass legislation tackling the greatest threat that our planet has ever faced. Or maybe not our planet. Let's say the human race. Climate change. Despite study after study proving that climate change is very real, that it's speeding up, that it's man-made, some Republicans are still saying, oh, no, it's just a hoax, don't you know? The majority of Republicans say they're skeptical at best. There's lots and lots of pressing issues facing America today. Rising education costs, out of whack tax system, crumbling infrastructure. But Republicans in Washington, they're taking a five-week vacation. And they're, frankly, more likely to pass a bill saying that Democrats are the spawn of Satan than they are to tackle the issues that really matter to Americans. Bottom line, it's time for Americans to wake up to what the Republicans are all about. What they're all about, of course, serving exclusively the rich, the well-bred, and the well-fed, and vote them out of office. Chances coming up. Okay, back to tipping. Now, one other thing I wanted to add, I just this article over at Think Progress by Bryce Covert. Tipping, he writes, also perpetuates racism and sexism. He quotes Elizabeth Gunnison Dunn, writing over at Esquire magazine, saying, quote, sexy women make bigger tips than less attractive ones, and white servers make more than their black coworkers. Now, the sexy women make bigger tips than less attractive ones. When I was a teenager going to college, I part of the way that I paid for what little college I attended was working as a dishwasher and a cook. And for one day, when they went out on strike, a waiter at Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing. And, yeah, I knew back then that the more attractive women made bigger tips, and they did too. I mean, this is no secret. White servers making more than black ones. I didn't know that. And I wonder if that's, you know, if you had white and black servers in the same restaurant, if that's the case, or if it's that restaurants that have an African-American staff in an African-American neighborhood, given the distribution of wealth in the United States, there could be, in many cases, less money in that neighborhood. So might it be that in a poorer neighborhood, you just don't make as much in tips? Which is not to stereotype all African-American neighborhoods as poor. Many are not, but still, interesting.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I would guess, though, that it's just a raw, awful number, as horrified as I am by it, that white servers make more than their black co-workers. We'll be right back. Hey, it's Thursday. My 2 minutes every week where I get to talk about Louise and Sean. Let me talk about science. Otherwise, I'd do it all day long. Anyhow, sugar may be sweet, but new studies suggest it's also a silent killer. First, a study was conducted by researchers at the University of Washington out in Seattle, Washington State, and that found that high blood glucose or sugar levels were associated with an increased risk of dementia in people, in the elderly. In that study, researchers recorded the blood sugar levels of 2,067 people, an average 76 years old, who all showed no signs of dementia. Some of these people had high blood sugar, but not diabetes. Some had high blood sugar with diabetes. After 5 years, around a quarter of the people in this study had developed some sort of dementia. But among the study participants that had high blood sugar but not diabetes, the risk of developing dementia was 18% greater than those with high blood glucose levels than in those with low levels. In participants with diabetes, the risk of dementia was 40% higher. The study didn't establish a specific biological link between high blood glucose or sugar and dementia, but they say that there's a relationship there and could be related to damage, that sugar causes damage to tiny blood vessels in the brain or insulin resistance. They're not sure. But wait, there's even more startling sugar news. Scientists announced on Tuesday that sugar is toxic for mice in dosages that in humans would equal a, quote, safe diet that includes 3 cans of soda a day. According to the study, researchers, mice fed a diet in which sugar contributed a quarter of their daily calories, died younger, and had fewer babies than animals on a healthy diet. In the experiment, scientists split 156 mice into two groups. One group was fed normal and healthy diet, while the other had a diet of naturally occurring carbohydrates, comprising a quarter of their diet replaced with added sugar, the kind you find in soda, candy, and baked goods. 26 weeks on this diet, two groups were placed together to live, compete, and breed for another 32 weeks with just regular food. All the mice fed the same diet. At the end of the experiment, 35% of the female mice fed the high sugar diet had died, compared to 17% of the mice in the other group. On the male mice, the male mice on the sugar diet sired 25% fewer offspring than those on the healthier diet and controlled 26% less territory. Biologist James Ruff, who co-authored the mouse study, said, "We have shown that levels of sugar that people typically consume and are considered safe by regulatory agencies impair the health of mice." He went on to say, "In the end, we have to ask ourselves the question, if it makes a mouse sick, do we want it in our bodies?" It's a really good question. Time to take a good hard look at the damage sugar is doing to our bodies. So, anyhow, Matt in Valparaiso, Indiana. Hey, Matt, you want to talk about tipping?
Absolutely, I do. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Sure.
I've been in the service industry for about 10 years. I actually do have a degree from Ball State in telecommunications. Mm-hmm. But as living wages go, tipping is, or working in restaurants, is about the best you can do in Indiana. And I make roughly $15 to $25 an hour. I also play music, so it frees up a lot of my time to do what I want to do.
Right.
But
you have the good fortune of, I'm guessing you have the good fortune of working in a restaurant that has a fairly high average check Because I'm guessing the people who are wait staff in a Denny's don't make that kind of money. Or am I wrong?
No, you are definitely right. But I am in a quantity over quality kind of corporation where I get a lot of tables. They're not so great tips, but, you know,
right.
You take enough tables, you make the money. But what
sure.
I was wanting to talk about was at Fridays when I worked there, I was offered insurance in 2012 for the first time.
Wow.
And I had a surgery that I needed to take care of on my wrist. I had a ganglion cyst.
Mm-hmm.
And my premiums alone would not be covered by my check along with my state and local taxes.
Wow.
What they do, they take your money out of your $213 an hour that we get in Indiana
mm-hmm.
into your premiums before they compensate your taxes or they take care of your taxes off of your paychecks. So
right.
I ended up owing over $700 for the first time ever in Indiana for my state taxes.
Wow. So you ended up working for nothing because of the cost of the health insurance, basically? You still there, Matt? Can you hear me? Matt, if you can hear me, I cannot hear you. I'm sorry.
I can hear you.
Whoop.
I'm sorry. I'm in a rural area. Can you hear me?
I did. I can. And I just pushed the button. I'm going to let my finger off it and hope that it doesn't dump you. If it does, my apologies. You can call back. No, you're still there. Okay. So
okay.
You...
Well, what I really wanted to
okay, go ahead.
Point out, too, from Red Robin is bussers and expediters, the people that are cleaning up the tables, they are also getting paid $213 an hour as well. And they do not get tips. They get tipped out from all servers and bartenders. And that is 1% of your sales. So every dollar on every $100 you sell for the company, you tip out to the bussers. They are not making minimum wage, Tom. There is
wow.
no way they are making close to minimum wage. And
wow.
it's slave labor. And they're actually mandated by Red Robin to claim minimum wage. Like we claim our tips
right.
as our earnings every night. And they have to claim minimum wage, even if they didn't make minimum wage.
Wow. Yeah. So if, in your opinion, then what should we do? Do away with tipping and pay everybody a living wage?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, at least in Illinois, our neighboring state, you get paid minimum wage. You get paid at least $8 an hour plus tips.
Right.
So the people working at Red Robin over in Illinois, they're getting a paycheck every 2 weeks.
Right.
So I definitely think that that is part of the solution. If you want a tip, yeah, that's great. I always think that generous tipping is a way to really, I don't know, improve the level of quality of life that you live. Because
yeah.
you just get better service for it. But
are you sure that there's a relationship between good service and good tipping?
I do. I really do.
There have been a couple of studies that indicate that there's a very small relationship, actually, relative to the size of the tip. But, you know, because the tip is done after the service is all over. Huh. I don't know. Okay, Matt, I'm sorry, we're out of time. But thank you for the call, and thank you for the thought-provoking comments. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Oh, by the way, Mitt Romney. Poor Mitt. Some sympathy for Mitt, please. Cayman Islands are going to start reporting cash over 50 grand. 28 minutes before the hour, President Obama being attacked over at the Daily Caller right-wing website. Obama gives up on Egypt, goes golfing. Oh, my God, he's playing golf? We can't have that. He's got to be sitting in the front of the White House with his chin on his fist and his palm and you know, gritting his teeth and worrying. I mean, you know, it's incredible. George W. Bush takes the longest vacation in the history of the American presidency. Ronald Reagan goes to bed every day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for years. Nobody pays any attention. Barack Obama goes off to play golf, and that's the end of that. Boy, oh, boy, we can't have. Anyway, Sandy in Rockford, Illinois. Hey, Sandy, what's up?
Hey. Hey, Tom, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get back.
You know what? We have been talking for a long time about the minimum wage, and I just want to tell you, last year I worked for Target, as a seasonal employee. In Illinois, it's $8.25 for our minimum wage, but we get paid $8.50.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to let you know that people there, a quarter of them, are on food stamps, the employees.
Right.
And
so you and I are all subsidizing. We're all subsidizing Target's business model.
Well, I want to let you, I want everybody to know that when you go to Target, you look at them, because when you go to their when you go to their through their
It's quite all right.
They put out loaves of bread and peanut butter and jelly.
Mm-hmm.
Jars of peanut butter and jelly.
Right.
This is how they subsidize their wages. They literally, if you go through
the aisles, are you talking about, or
No. I'm talking through their break room. Through the
In the break room.
This,
okay.
This is how they subsidize their wages. If you want to save some money, you go through there. They put out loaves of bread and peanut butter. And jelly.
You mean Target pays for the bread and the peanut butter and jelly?
They put this in the break room for their employees.
Oh, so you get free food, but the free food is peanut butter jelly sandwiches.
Yes, yes. This is how they subsidize their wages.
Wow. Wow. That's remarkable. Now, you don't know if that's an industry-wide practice or if this is just the local store owner thinking.
No, this is the one that I personally worked at.
Right.
But, this is what they do. And they're very proud of it. They're very, very, very proud of it. If you want to save some money, here you are. Here's some loaves of bread. Here's some jars of peanut butter and jelly. Have at it.
Yeah.
This is how we help you.
Instead of paying you a decent wage. Amazing.
And I'll tell you that more than a quarter of these people are on food stamps already. I was very surprised.
Yeah. I'm familiar with those statistics. Sandy, thank you for calling and sharing your story. That's amazing. Brent in Goldwaith, Texas. Hey, Brent.
Very good pronunciation there, Tom.
Thank you.
I didn't know which way I was going to take this, but since your last few guys have talked about the service industry and such, the one that just gets me is – right now, the current American dream is to take a cruise.
Right.
You know, and you mentioned this early on in the show. It's affordable. You got to save up. But what you're going to do is be isolated from everybody. You're going to have white people that speak bad English wait on you, so you don't have that, you know, that taboo of possibly exploiting those workers that we know are on there.
Mm.
You know, I found that. Like, if I do relaxation time or vacations, have to stay at a hotel, I'm going to relax best if I don't have valet, if I don't have porters, if I don't have – because I help, you know?
Yeah.
I don't want to put –
Have you been on a cruise, Brent?
No, sir.
Okay. I used to own a travel agency. Louise and I started a travel agency in 1983 in Atlanta. We sold it in 86. And they gave us free cruises all the time. And we would take my parents on them, and I've been on a bunch of them, and across the Atlantic and all over the Caribbean and across Asia and whatnot, and the Mediterranean. And I can tell you that industry really, really does exploit its workers on the one hand. On the one hand, you've got people, they're principally Filipinos and people from Malaysia, Indonesia, they're from that, you know, the Pacific Rim countries where English is well spoken and their English is very good, but the poverty levels are really, really high. And so they get these workers and they pay them virtually nothing. I mean, you know, a few thousand dollars a year, I don't remember the statistics, but it's very, very low. And then when you get on the cruise, you are basically told your expected tip to the guy who's taking care of your room when you're done with a cruise is $50 or $100, depending on the cruise line. You're expected to give this guy $100. You're expected to give your waiter at the table, you know, $50 or $100. So you bring with you when you go on a cruise, you bring a couple of $100, $200, $300, $400, $500 just for tips that you're going to pass out at the very end of the cruise. And in fact, they make it very convenient. You can put it on your credit card. You could just check it off on a sheet and ding your credit card for it. And this way, the cost of their labor is not, you know, it doesn't run through their bookkeeping. And these people are getting it in ways that, you know, the cruise lines don't have to, presumably don't have to pay taxes on it. So that all seems incredibly exploitative. On the other hand, I've talked to a bunch of these people who work on cruises, a bunch of the folks who work on the cruise lines, and they're literally, in many cases, supporting large extended families back home. And these are jobs that in some cases, they have to wait years and years to be able to get. So it's really it's one of those kind of awkward demonstrations of how rich the developed world is and how poor the third world is, because it's first world people who are taking the cruises and it's third world people working on the cruises, and the collision of those two worlds. It's fascinating, and I still struggle with it. It's the only cruise line that doesn't do it this way is, and I'm not even sure if they're still in business, but it used to be called the Something American Cruise Line. They did the cruises in Hawaii, and they only do it around the Hawaiian Islands, and they can't do that because they're exclusively in the United States. Maybe there's some that go up and down the Mississippi and down the East Coast where they actually hire American workers and they pay them decent wages because they have to. But this is how it works with the international cruises, and it's a very, very interesting little subculture. Brent, thanks for the call. Tara in Hopland, California. Hey, Tara, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk to you about this aid to Egypt, mm-hmm. which I'm seeing covered on other channels, but they leave out the important fact that we don't actually give any money to Egypt. What we do is we make contracts with American defense contractors, and Egypt takes basically what we give them. So if we default on our commitment to Egypt, actually we're going to have to pay fines for defaulting on these defense contracts that we have with right. American defense contractors.
Plus tens of thousands of Americans will go out of work because, you know, $1 billion worth of weapons
right.
that are being manufactured in the United States aren't being manufactured anymore. And this is why Congress is addicted to foreign aid, because it's actually these are make-work programs. And you're right, the money never even leaves the United States. The Egyptian funds, the Egyptian foreign aid money, goes into a checking account in Washington, D.C. They write a check from that account to the defense contractors in Virginia and the ring around Washington, D.C. You know, they send some of that money off to the low-wage, right-to-work-for-less states where they manufacture a lot of this stuff, the so-called red states, which is why the Republicans are so gung-ho on the military. And and then after the tanks and planes and bullets and guns and stuff are made, that's what gets shipped over to Egypt. And this is one of the reasons why the protesters are so upset. You see, because the tear gas canisters that are being thrown at them say "Made in USA," literally say "Made in USA" on them. The tanks are made in the United States, the planes, the helicopters, and they know it. You're absolutely right, Tara. Thanks for calling and sharing that. Wally in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Got a minute to the break. Wally, it's yours. What's up?
Tom, I'll be quick. I just wanted to say to the previous caller, the minimum wage for the front of the house employees, servers in Illinois is right now, I think, currently at $4.65 an hour. I'm a lifelong restaurant employee. In regards to the busboys and stuff like that, the reason that the corporations like to pretend that they make $8.50 an hour is because anytime you get a tip differential, any amount of money that you don't make up to that $8.50 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is, the restaurant or the corporation is required to cover and boost you up to that minimum wage amount.
Right.
So that just creates a whole lot of money and math and all that other stuff.
Right, and I'm guessing that a lot of the folks who are getting screwed like this are people who are here without documentation and therefore unable to call the Labor Department and lodge a complaint.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I've had to file labor complaints myself, and I got to say this, the Labor Department works for the workers if you're willing to file that piece of paperwork for 5 minutes.
Right, but you got to be a citizen.
And that... Exactly, but that's the way it goes. And, you know, the pervasiveness of the illegal immigrants and stuff and the undocumented workers within the restaurant industry is just ridiculous. It really is just ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay. Wally, thanks for sharing your insight, wisdom, and experience with us. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WCPT. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, Texas now. The Texas Republicans, they're saying, we didn't redraw our districts in a racist way. We just did it to suppress Democratic votes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Zach Badorf with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, is on the line with us. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you located right now, Zach?
So I'm in Shanli Urfa, which is about half an hour by car from the Syrian border. Just today, I went to a refugee camp right on the border with UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund.
This is the border between Syria and what?
Border between Turkey and Syria.
Turkey, okay.
I'm in Turkey, and, I was there at the refugee camp where about 10,000 Syrians are living in tents. Some of them have been there for over a year.
Wow.
They're living in really, really tough conditions. It's really hot. I was out there for just a handful of hours, and I was kind of miserable. These folks have been in this situation, fleeing a war, and they want to go home. They're ready to resume their lives, but unfortunately, conflict across the border in Syria, it doesn't look like it's going to get any better anytime soon.
Right. We're talking with Zach Badorf, who's in Turkey reporting on Syria. His website, Badorf, BADDORF.com. His Twitter, at Zach Badorf, ZACHBADDORF. Zach, what's your sense of how this is playing out in Syria?
Basically the country is divided into three parts at this point. You've got the Kurds up in the north, who are they've been pretty much autonomous at this point. And they're fighting against both Al-Qaeda and the Syrian government. So then that's the first part in the north.
Right.
And then you've got the FSA groups, which is the Free Syrian Army, and that's the main rebel group that has about 150,000 soldiers in various parts, mostly along the western part of the country, in Aleppo, parts of Homs, and other parts. And then you've got, of course, the Syrian regime, controlled by Bashar al-Assad, the president, which is, bombing people with their aircraft. They've got tanks, and they, 100,000 people have been killed so far in this conflict.
Yeah.
Just a few days ago, I was in Istanbul, the capital of Turkey, and I spoke with the head of the Syrian National Council. Now, he is one of the main representatives for this, sort of government in waiting, as they hope that the Syrian government falls eventually. So what he says is they really need these rebels, unless there's going to be some sort of change, unless to bring about some sort of change, they need better weapons, anti-aircraft, anti-tank weapons to, allow the Syrian people in these areas to defend themselves.
Right. This is a tough one. I mean, you look at what happened in Tunisia and what happened in Egypt, and in both cases, the revolutions were successful without violence. I mean, they were nonviolent rebellions. The idea of further arming that region has a lot of people, very concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, and also there are a lot of reports that these rebel groups are not just rebel groups, that some of them are Al-Qaeda affiliated, some of them are fundamentalist Islamic groups, some of them are just, warlords who are basically looking to make a buck on a war. What's your sense of what's going on there? Or what are you hearing? What's the reporting that you're hearing?
You hit on some important points there. That obviously us in the U.S. and other Western countries, our biggest concern is creating another Afghanistan, where we essentially funded the folks that became the radicals over there that became Taliban and years later.
Right.
So we don't want this blowback. So how do we prevent these weapons? If we provide them at all, none have really arrived at this point, at least directly. How do we prevent these weapons from falling in the hands of Al-Qaeda. I mean, they're pouring in. I mean, the head of Al-Qaeda in Iraq just relocated to Syria, and the U.S. State Department just put out a $10 million bounty on his head. I mean, these Islamists are moving in. And in fact, they're targeting Western journalists very heavily. I mean, I've been talking to a lot of journalists who have been reporting on the conflict for years, you know, since it started 28 months ago, and they're not going in anymore. I mean, it has become that bad. You know, you don't necessarily hear about all the kidnappings because some folks want to keep it quiet, and you know, as the negotiations go on. But you know, there are a lot of journalists who are abducted, and right now, Western journalists in captivity by Islamist groups in Syria,
being held for ransom,
threat. Ransom and political reasons, and you know, maybe a video will come out, you know, that shows them being killed. I mean, it's a really, really dicey situation. I know for a fact that some of them have been beaten and tortured. I mean, it's a really tough situation to report on. But not only that, we have to be concerned about, you know, what sort of weapons that these Al-Qaeda Islamist groups will have access to, and what sort of influence will they have on the region once, you know, the Assad regime eventually falls.
Right. And the Assad regime, what's the relationship between other power brokers in the region, the Saudi Arabias, the Qataris, the other Arab countries in the region, and the Assad government?
Yeah, that's also a very important thing to talk about. It's not just a conflict in Syria. This has become a proxy war for many of the countries. I mean, the reason I'm so interested in Syria is because all these different power players are so involved. I mean, you've got a sectarian divide where the Shias, mostly Iran, and Lebanon with Hezbollah, are supporting Assad, you know, which is mostly Shia Alawite.
Right.
So, and then on the other hand, you've got the Sunnis, who are mostly the rebel groups. You've got Al-Qaeda coming in. You've got Saudi Arabia. You've got Qatar. All these other regional players, plus us, the United States.
Zach, we're out of time. A very, very quick question. Do you think that this region has the potential for a World War I the scenario where, you know, it just trips off a domino effect?
I don't know if we'll have that sort of situation exactly, but I think
we're out of time.
Tom
sorry.
Hartman.
Thank you for reporting.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, boy, we've covered a lot of territory today. We just had a report from Turkey on the border of Syria where Zach Badarf was reporting what's going on there. That he's not so – he's a little more sanguine about the possibility of a World War I Archduke Ferdinand scenario. I'm frankly quite concerned about it. I think there are so many proxy players in Syria right now. But, you know, we'll see how this all plays out. We've talked about Egypt and how American foreign aid actually never even makes it outside the United States. It just goes to defense contractors here in the United States. And thus, we basically set up what's going on in Egypt. We've been talking about tipping and how restaurants, the whole tipping business is not only promoting racism and sexism and a low wage economy, but also, you know, is exploiting the worker. It's another symptom of this, just the whole problem with the American economy right now, that, you know, the rich get richer and working people are screwed. And then on top of this, it's like, you know, do you even have the right in America to know what's in your food? I mean, I'd like to know. The federal government just came out with new guidelines for people with celiac disease. I am one of those people. I can't eat stuff that has wheat protein, otherwise known as gluten, in it, wheat, rye, or barley. And so now you can, if you've below 20 parts per million, you can label your product as gluten-free. And I know from personal experience, 20 parts per million would not bother me at all. But when you start getting into actual, you know, significant amounts of wheat, I am out of commission for the entire next day. Balin Linekin is on the line with us, an attorney and executive director of KeepFoodLegal.org. Balin, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me on, Tom.
So let me get this right. From reading your articles, it seems that what you're saying is that the food companies should have the freedom to tell us if they choose to or not tell us if they choose to whatever's in their food, and they can use any kind of labeling or descriptor that they want because somehow the free market will magically keep everything copacetic. Do I have that right?
That may be an oversimplification of my position. I think that food companies should be forced by the FDA to label ingredients, for example. I'm fine with that, to have their mailing address, their company name, their product name.
So do you think genetically modified organisms, GMOs, should be disclosed?
No, I don't, actually. I think they should be voluntarily
disclosed.
Is that
not an ingredient? You just said they should be forced to label their ingredients.
Well, we don't say that currently that we have to label corn because it's from Iowa. We don't get
being
that
from
specific.
Iowa doesn't mean that the plants have animal genes in them.
That's true. I guess I'm not convinced that the science would. What is the reason?
European Union is convinced that the science is problematic. There's a fair body of work that indicates that GMOs themselves may have. May cause things like kidney problems. And then on top of that, a lot of genetically modified organisms are designed to contain, for example, their own pesticides. BT corn, for example, Bacillus thermophilus is a pesticide that is produced with an animal gene that is produced by that corn itself. So the corn is saturated with a pesticide far more than you would get if you were eating corn that had been simply sprayed with pesticide periodically and then been washed. And, there's some evidence that people react badly to having BT pesticide, literally integrated into every cell in the corn that they're eating. So the Europeans have said, no, not so much. Thank you very much. And, I mean, they're not even just saying you got to label it. They're just saying we don't even want it. Japan, the same thing.
That's true. Luckily, we're not Europe or Japan. We allow more freedom in this country, especially as pertains to food choices.
Freedom for the manufacturers.
And for consumers. I mean, there are consumers who are pro-GMO. I'm neither pro-GMO.
How am I free if I'm pro-GMO or anti-GMO if I don't know? How am I free?
Well, you can buy organic food, which is, I think, definitionally free of GMOs.
But if big government is not defining that, that definition doesn't have any weight.
Actually, organic food used to have a great deal more weight than it currently does. I think if you ask anyone in 1985 if they bought something that was organic, it actually meant something. And as soon as the USDA took over the labeling scheme, with the law that was went into force in the early 2000s, it became
Respectfully, you're misremembering your history. Back in 1978, my wife and I started a community for abused kids up in New Hampshire that was vegetarian and health food diet, for kids with ADHD. And we used to get a lot of our donations out of the health food industry. I went to the natural food, the NFA, Natural Food Association's, I think it was actually NNFA, National Nutritional Foods Association's annual meeting. Dennis Weaver and his family did a couple of years in a row, sang for us. Dick Gregory came and did a performance for us. Erewhon, which was a big natural foods distributor in Boston, supplied a lot of our food. And I was in the middle of those debates. There were screaming, shouting fests. There were big companies versus little companies. There was the companies coming into the natural foods industry, like the big cereal producers, who had completely different standards than the small companies. It was a mess back in the late 70s and throughout the 80s until the government stepped in and said, okay, here's what organic means.
Well,
I was there.
Everything, and I was, while I'm from the Boston area, and so I was situated there, I was also in elementary school at that time, so I can't say that I was there per se, but I've certainly read about the history, and I know that a lot of the complaints that you're listing right now about, big producers coming in and little producers being squeezed out, those are exactly the same things that are the complaints about the USDA organic certification program right now, today.
How so?
if you go to any sort of information page about organics, you have a farmer like Joel Salatin in Virginia, for example, Polyphase Farms, who now has essentially opted out of organic and has billed himself as beyond organic because organic is much less meaningful than local and sustainable.
Well, that's great. That's an example of your marketplace that you're talking about. You know, he's saying I'm not just meeting the U.S. standards. I'm even better. But at least we have some standards. I mean, there didn't used to be any standards.
He's not meeting the standards necessarily. It's expensive. I mean, well, a small farmer. He probably is exceeding them, as are many farmers.
But back to this again. You haven't explained to me how I am more free. If big food companies can conceal from me what's in the food I'm eating.
Well, let's use the example of organic food again to sort of, we don't force producers who, small farmers who use cow manure to fertilize their food to label their product by saying this product grown in animal feces. Even though we know that animal feces sometimes sicken people, have, certainly
if you eat
noticeable
raw
impact. Well, yeah, but I mean, and things like lettuce and spinach and cantaloupe and all those things are things that are fertilized with animal feces and that we do tend to eat raw. But we don't force those growers to.
But those things are washed. Okay, all right. We don't force the. I don't understand how not disclose how. I'm not hearing an answer to my question. How am I more free because a food company can conceal from me that there's feces on my food?
So you're suggesting that there should be a label, this product grown in animal feces?
Well, if it's actually a legitimate, I don't think it's a legitimate problem. But if it were, yeah, absolutely. If it's killing people, then you're making a strong argument for requiring that on the label. How am I more free if my food might kill me because there's animal feces on it and the manufacturer doesn't have to tell me? How does that make me more free?
We're going to commercial?
Yeah, we are.
Okay.
You get the last word.
Everyone is more free when voluntary labeling exists. And the idea of going to some sort of fecal labeling for organic food is not
okay.
Going to help.
Got it. Balin Lineken, keepfoodlegal.org. Hang on, just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Balin, thanks a lot for dropping by today.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
Good talking with you. Sure. We'll be right back. Exposing the con in conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Jerry in Boonville, Indiana. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
Hey, I wanted to say, tip jobs, some of them in the expensive resort towns, that's the only way you can make a living wage.
Yeah, I know there are people working in high-end restaurants in New York City on tips who are making $60,000-$80,000 a year, but they are few and far between.
Yeah, but you got to count all the resort towns around across America too.
Yeah.
And those are the only places you can make a living, and that's taxi driving, bellman, ski valet,
right.
So
shouldn't we be reconsidering this and saying, okay, let's just raise the minimum wage to $15 or $20 an hour? I mean, the minimum wage right now, if it were from the day Ronald Reagan came into office until today, if the minimum wage had kept up with productivity, with the money that corporations are spinning off that right now is going into corporate profits, excess corporate profits, and excess CEO salaries, if corporate profits and CEO salaries were today where they were in 1980, and the wages from that productivity were going to working people, the minimum wage right now would be around $22 an hour. Why don't we just make it that?
Well, let's take Aspen, for instance, right? Aspen, you can qualify for subsidized housing if you make less than $80,000 a year. So that's how expensive it is. So even
right.
at that
Aspen, Colorado.
High minimum wage, yeah, you couldn't make it there on $20,000.
Well, then a local community can say, okay, in our community, it's incredibly expensive to live here, and most of the people who come hang out here in Aspen are millionaires and billionaires, so we're going to set our minimum wage at $30 an hour.
But they don't. What they do is they take people with green cards and the visas, and they fill those spots.
I know.
So the fact is the minimum wage doesn't rise, and tips are a percentage of the cost of things, and they do rise.
Right.
So you can't get rid of it because the problems, underlying problems, aren't fixed.
Yeah. Well, right? One way to do that would be to, if we had simply indexed the minimum wage to inflation and nothing else. I mean, I was talking a minute ago about indexing it to productivity. If we just indexed it to inflation in 1968, it would be $10.50 right now.
Yeah, but who can live on $10.50 an hour?
Well, it's a hell of a lot better than trying to live on $7.25 an hour.
Right, but if you've got the a good tip job, you're making well over that.
Yeah, I mean, well, I agree with you on that point. But what I'm saying is that they're few and far between. Those are the exceptions that prove the rule. They're not. That's not the standard in America. Most tip jobs are not good tip jobs.
Right, that's true. But what I would do is I would say, if you're, if you're waiting tables, if you're for your shift, what your ring is at the end of the shift is under a certain amount, then you should fall into the minimum wage category.
Right. Then you get brought up to it. Yeah. Well, and that's how it does work actually by law. The problem is the minimum wage is set so low it's absurd. Jerry, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Chris in Erie, Colorado, listening on KKZN. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Yeah, how's it going, Tom? You know, I'm actually living in Colorado now, but I was living in Oregon, and thank God they do have the minimum wage for the server industry in Oregon, one of the few progressive states in America. But I was listening to a local host here in Denver. He's not a crank. He's a genuine, loyal opposition conservative. But I brought up to him, a talking point that we've always had about the CEO-to-worker ratio, pre-Reagan it was 30 to 1, and today it's 3,000, 4,000 to 1. And he said that it was, it wasn't because that it was compensation in cash, that it was stock options, and that was counted as total compensation. What happened after Reagan that let all the CEOs accumulate all the stocks? And can we take a lot of those stocks and,
sure,
make a law that, puts the stocks in the workers' hands?
Yes, I can answer that real quickly, Chris. What happened was during the Reagan administration, prior to the Reagan administration, the tax law did not allow corporations to compensate CEOs and senior executives with stock options. Just didn't allow for it. And then therefore they had to take their pay as salary. So the guy, your conservative host, told you a half truth. It wasn't counted because it wasn't legal. Okay. After what Reagan did was, and the theory was, if we make the CEOs into stockholders, the stockholders theoretically own the company, so they will begin behaving in the best interests of the owners, and that's a desirable outcome in the minds of the Reaganites. Turns out it's an undesirable outcome, because the stockholders typically actually don't care about the company they own stock in. They're just investors. They're just looking to make a buck, most the stockholders. They don't care whether General Electric is around 30 years from now or not. And so what happened was that the CEOs and the senior executives being compensated this way started behaving in a way that was actually destructive to the company, which is why so many companies have been destroyed by this, and they got insanely rich. And, with stock options. And then the third part of it was, because they're being paid with stock options, they make $1 million in salary and then they make $100 million in stock options. The stock options, when they exercise those options, if it's more than a year out, that's called long-term capital gains. The top capital gains income tax, you don't pay 39% income tax on capital gains. You pay a maximum of 20%. Up until last year, it was a maximum of 15%. And so,
And so
that's how these guys get so rich. The rich have their very own tax category, their own tax bracket called capital gains, which you and I don't qualify for if we're just drawing a paycheck. The average working person, no way in hell are they ever going to, they may have a little bit in their 401k or something, but that's it. And this is the scam. And it was a scam that was put into law with the advocacy of Ronald Reagan by right-wing economists, by the Chicago School guys, the boys, they called themselves the Chicago School Boys, the Milton Friedman Group, back in the 1980s. I think it was 85 or 86 that they changed the tax code to allow executives to be compensated with stock options.
And now, do you think that, what can we do to...
we can undo that rule. We can simply undo it. We can just say we're going back to the way it was in America, the tax code back the way it was before Reagan. We're going to roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and we're going to change the compensation rules for executives within a company that they can no longer take pay as stock options. If they want to take $1 million or $5 million or $1 billion, in the case of Stephen Hemsley with United Healthcare, that $1 billion did not come out as a paycheck you know, with a W-2 attached to it. Most of it came as stock options, and the maximum tax he paid on most of that was probably 15%. So we just undo the damage that Reagan did. We need a revolution to change the Reagan Revolution, to undo the Reagan Revolution.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If you want the details on this, I wrote a book called Rebooting the American Dream, and there's a chapter that deals with this in some detail on it. It's free over at truthout.org online. And the very, very supalectically ugly, the good. The Seattle Police Department. This weekend, Seattle's going to hold its first Hemp Fest pot celebration since Washington State legalized marijuana last year. And when thousands of weed smokers descend on the city starting on Friday, they'll get a crunchy surprise courtesy of the Seattle Police Department. Instead of busting pot smokers, Seattle cops will give them bags of yummy Dorito snacks. The bags will also contain pamphlets outlining the details of Washington State's new marijuana law. Good work, Seattle Police Department. The war on drugs is a failure. Let the war on munchies begin. The bad. Paul Stamm. North Carolina's House Majority Leader is under fire today for comments he made to the News and Observer newspaper about Tar Heel State School Superintendent June Atkinson. When asked about Atkinson's recent proposal to expand standardized testing to both public and private schools, Stamm told the paper that the superintendent, who is female, quote, should stick to her own knitting. There is the possibility that the majority leader Stamm simply meant that the superintendent should mind her own business, but given the North Carolina Republican Party's spotty track record on gender equality these days, it's hard to see his remarks as anything but sexist and bad for schools. And the very, very ugly, John Kraft, the assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Texas, finds himself embroiled in controversy today for a comment he posted to a private Facebook page in which he apparently pretended to be Trayvon Martin. According to the Beaumont Enterprise, a local Texas paper, Kraft wrote, "How are you fixed for Skittles, an Arizona watermelon fruit cocktail, or maybe a bottle of Robitussin 2 in your neighborhood? I am fresh out of purple drank, so I may come by for a visit in a rainstorm in the middle of the night in a hoodie. Don't get upset or anything if you see me looking in your window, okay?" Private Facebook page or not, for a public official like Kraft to make completely racist comments like that is very, very ugly. That's incredibly ugly. Okay, Jason in Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Jason, you wanted to talk about the minimum wage?
Hey, how's it going? Hey, I just wanted to comment, you know, if we do raise the minimum wage, we have to realize that the inflation numbers are not just going to go up a little bit, they'll skyrocket, right?
Well, let's see. 1938, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed.
No. If you raise wage,
Jason, let me finish my sentence. I'll give you a chance to rebut it. In 1938, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, the minimum wage was first established, and it was set at 25 cents an hour. At that time, the prevailing wage was around 20 cents an hour. Since that 25 cent an hour minimum wage, it's gone up a whole bunch of times. I don't remember the exact number, but it's gone up a whole bunch of times. Can you identify for me, because it's now at $7.25 an hour, can you identify for me any year where raising the minimum wage produced a measurable increase in inflation?
Tom, I don't have a chart in front of me, but if you raise wages, which are usually the largest cost in an object or service.
Not true.
You will have inflation.
Wages are rarely the largest cost in a product or service. First of all,
really?
And yes.
So I'll take restaurant industry. Is it the food or is it the labor going in to make the food?
Well, restaurants might be the exception that prove the rule. Although I would guess that probably rent and electricity and, you know, I've never run a restaurant, so I can't tell you. But I have run a lot of other businesses.
It's not 5% of manufacturing costs.
But 9%. Okay.
As long as we
Shano used to run a restaurant. He says wages are 9% of costs. Typically in the industry.
So there will be inflation.
Jason, if there was any one year between 1938 and today when raising the minimum wage actually produced a measurable increase in inflation, every one of the conservative mentors that you have would have caused you to memorize that year. You'd be saying, oh, you don't want to repeat what happened in 1962.
Tom, what's the minimum wage now?
$7.25.
Okay, and what do you say to raise it to get to the adjusted number?
Well, let's take it at least to $10.25 an hour, which is what it was in 1968.
Fine, let's do that. The previous increases in these wages that you were talking about in the past were probably a smaller percentage than what you're proposing in terms of moving it to this $10.
Well, actually, by taking it to $10.25, because about half the states in the United States have a minimum wage that's in the $8 neighborhood, it's not going to be
so you've got a 25% increase in wages.
I don't think that. 25%. No, absolutely not. If you take all the wages paid in a state, and you pull out of that of the percentage of the wages that are being paid at the minimum wage, it's probably under 10 or 15% of total wages. Not wage earners, but wages.
Look, you're not talking about raising it like 20 cents or 30 cents. We're talking dollars per hour here.
You're absolutely right.
20% increase.
You're absolutely right. But you've got, in any given state, you've got people who are making $50,000 a year. You've got people who are making $100,000 a year. You've got people making $300,000 a year. You've got people making $1 million, $2 million, $5 million dollars a year. When you average out all that wage income that's happening in that state, and then you pull out that small little slice of it that's the number, that's the people who are just working at the minimum wage, even raising the minimum wage by $2 is not going to raise the total wages paid in that state by any kind of measurable amount, and that's why it has never produced inflation in the past.
Half the population and most of the job growth over the last 4 or 5 years have been low-wage jobs.
But that is maybe half the population, but it's not half the wages.
That will cause inflation.
Jason, if you're going to do the math, you've got to use the right numbers. That's not half the wages.
What percentage of the population?
It's not. You're talking about population. I'm talking about wages.
Okay, so let's go through this. What percentage of the population makes less than 30% per year?
What is the average? What is the median income in the United States?
Probably $46,000 for households.
Yeah, per household, or $26,000 per individual.
And we know, Tom, that the number of new jobs being created are part-time, the majority of them, part-time jobs or low-paying jobs. So
that's correct, but only 3% of jobs in the United States are actually at the federal minimum wage.
So when we go forward, though, you're going to talk about raising prices. So you're going to go into McDonald's, and it'll be more expensive for a hamburger. You'll go and get these other services, and it'll be more expensive.
Yes.
It's an inflationary number. Just like we outsource stuff to other countries, that kept inflation checked. Now, look,
you cannot identify, Jason, any year when raising the minimum wage has produced inflation, number one. And number two, let's say it does. Let's say you're right.
It by a large amount.
Let's say that you're right. Let's say you're absolutely right. I would still rather live in a country where the low end of the wage scale workers are making a reasonable wage and pay an extra 25 cents for a Big Mac than I would live in a country where wealthy people can buy Big Macs very cheap, so that, and again, the consequence of that is that the working poor are slammed in poverty that is just destructive of families.
And the majority of the people that buy McDonald's burgers, are they rich people or poor people?
I do not know.
Probably poor people. I don't see too many Mercedes.
Well, if you raise their wages, they'll be able to afford more McDonald's. Again, the cost of the burger is not 100% labor. It's 9% labor.
When we're dealing with these.
Center for American Progress did the math on this, Jason. You can go look at their website, thinkprogress.org. If you were to raise the minimum wage to $10.25 an hour, it would increase the cost of a Big Mac by about 50 cents.
And how much does a Big Mac cost?
I don't know. $2 and change. It's not a Big Mac.
$4.
Let's say it's $4.
Okay. So 50 cents on that, the price has now gone up about 18%.
Okay.
All right, so that would be 18%.
And the wages have gone up how much? And the wages of the workers have gone up how much?
But we're talking about a smaller group relative to a worker.
So there's an 18% increase on the 9% of the total costs to McDonald's. Oh, okay, you're talking about the 18% cost on the increase of the cost of the burger. So the wages of the worker. So it's a wash. It's a wash for the guy making $7.25 an hour because his wages just went up 18% and the cost of his burger went up 18%, right?
When you keep citing this stuff from the past, remember the increases in the minimum wage from this 1930s. These weren't gigantic jumps in the amount of...
Some of them were quite significant.
From what time, what period to what period?
Well, just like you, I don't have the whole list in front of me, but again...
There we go, so don't to pretend like it wasn't inflationary.
Jason, if you want to debate the minutiae of the minimum wage, we should schedule it so I can both of us can have it printed out in front of us. But the fact of the matter is that I would like to, and you don't want to, and I think that we're both very clear on this, I would like to fundamentally reorder our economy so that we no longer have in this country the working poor.
That it won't be inflationary.
I think that we should be looking at Germany, we should be looking at Sweden, we should be looking at Norway, Denmark, Finland. They do not have the working poor in those countries. They have a reasonable minimum wage. We should do the same. Yes, there's going to be some economic dislocation as a consequence of it, but most of that economic dislocation is going to happen at the top, not the bottom.
But let's not pretend it won't be inflationary.
I don't think it's going to be inflationary in the general sense. No, I don't think so. If you're talking about if it's going to debase the currency,
if we have a minimum wage for people harvesting our food or something like that, then won't that make the price of apples and peaches and stuff, won't that make it more expensive? Because the labor is a big part of that, right?
I don't know what percentage of it is, but I would be surprised if it's more than 5 or 10%.
Well, that's why this whole part of
transportation's a big part of it. We saw the oil companies double and triple the cost of the oil that's used to get the food to you. You saw an increase in food prices. It didn't bring down the Republic.
Price of the purchasing power of a dollar gone down.
Purchasing power of the dollar has gone down for largely monetary policy reasons. It goes down, and it does all over the world, because governments want to borrow money cheap or borrow money expensive and pay it back cheap. That's a whole different argument, Jason. Thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Jason's getting pretty good. Someday they're going to, Fox should be offering him a talk show. We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Ronald in Chicago. Hey, Ronald, what's up? Ronald? Oh, Ronald just, I think he tried to take me off speaker and he dropped the call. Give us a shout back, Ronald. There's one line open. Ron in Santa Maria, California. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yes, thanks, Tom. I wanted to call about the health care, Obamacare, and some of the provisions being pushed back, delayed,
right.
whatever they're doing. And I'm not an expert in that, but I wanted to frame it in the context of the airbags. It's going back a ways, but when the government was trying to mandate that car companies put airbags in, they screamed and cried and whined, saying they just couldn't get it done, and it kept getting pushed back, as I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But now looking back, would we have wanted to kill airbags at that point because it was getting pushed back?
Excellent point.
I think, maybe as long as airbags have been in, if we go 20 years into the future, we may look back and say, well, Obamacare wasn't perfect. It's like, we needed to go in that direction.
Yeah.
And if some things got delayed, well, so be it.
I agree. I totally agree. And your logic is perfect. And the airbag example is brilliant, because I remember Lee Iacocca saying that airbags would put Chrysler out of business. And boy, was he wrong. And, and then they'd said the same thing about seatbelts back in 72, 73, when Ralph Nader published Unsafe at Any Speed. So, yes, totally with you, Ron. Thank you for the call. Joan, maybe it was earlier than that. Maybe it was the late 60s. Anyhow, Joan in Alexander, North Carolina. Hey, Joan, you were a waitress in Chattanooga?
Yes, I was for a while at a Cracker Barrel. And the wages there were $2.05 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And they assured us in the beginning, don't worry, you'll make it up in tips. But as at Cracker Barrel, people are notoriously lousy tippers. I think they've spent it all in the gift shop first before they get in there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, if you were an opener, which I usually was, it meant you came in an hour and a half early, you made all the tea and coffee and everything. And if it was slow, you got sent home early. And if you didn't claim enough on your tips in order to bring you up to whatever the minimum wage was at the time, then they'd actually call you in the office and kind of threaten you with losing your job if you didn't start claiming more in tips.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's illegal.
Yeah. So anyway, and Jason is an idiot. Okay.
Okay. Well, Jason, you know, he's got his perspective, and he's probably, you know, he probably just made a little money for, you know, whoever pays him to call into talk radio. But Joan, thank you for the call. And I enjoy a good intellectual workout every now and then. Darren in Seattle. Hey, Darren, thanks for calling, for listening to KBCS. What's up? Darren? Darren can't hear me. Sounds like he's at the Hemp Fest, which I think starts tomorrow. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin.
Hey, brother man. Listen, if I may first, please, then let me go on about the minimum wage. I'll try to be brief. There's a super good article on Henry Mako, HENRYMAKOW.com, and it's about Bin Laden, Hamas, Islamist, CIA, Mossad tools.
Okay.
And the guy says, it names all the names, all the sources, all the books, all the documentation, the money changers and their whores in Congress are playing us all for suckers. They're getting filthy rich with the defense contracts, the oil contracts.
Yeah.
We're going without health care, without decent retirements for the middle class, without good super education, without our factories so that we're sovereign and we can pull the hell out of this ditch that they put us in the last 40 years. He says, quote, the U.S. battles Islamists in Afghanistan and finances them in Syria. They are pawns in the Illuminati's great game.
Yeah.
This guy is, his name's Charles Upton.
Okay, Armin, thank you for that, and thanks for the information. Take the Illuminati part out of it, and I'm with you. Ian, in Chicago, do not go to KnightsTemplar.com. That's my last advice. Ian in Chicago. Hey, Ian, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good. Got about 2 minutes here, Ian. Quick one?
Yeah, sure. I'll make it quick. So what I wanted to comment on was that conservative gentleman you were just speaking with a minute ago.
Right.
You had a great argument against him, but you were missing just one thing, and that's the simple fact that his inflation is the decision of the companies if they want to inflate their prices, because if the CEO isn't going to take any kind of pay cut or the executives aren't going to take any, you know, kind of restructuring to the company to increase the wages, that's just under the current rules.
You're absolutely right. I totally forgot that piece. Yeah, if the wages go up at McDonald's, then McDonald's can reduce the dividend that they pay to the stockholders. They can cut the CEO's pay, and they can keep the burger prices right where they are right now. And then we get back to the pay distributions we had before Reagan.
Great. I just wanted to make sure that you got that out.
Thank you. You are brilliant, Ian. You are brilliant. Thank you for being that part of my brain that I had lost during that five-minute debate. I appreciate it. Thanks for listening to WCPT. Jack in Longmont, Colorado. Got a minute left, Jack. Thanks for listening to 760 AM. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to relate a story that you probably heard before about Henry Ford when he started his assembly line. And the prevailing wage was about a dollar a day then. And he started paying an unprecedented.
Jack, you just faded out. You still there? I think your cell phone is croaking.
Corporations forgot any of this?
Yeah, let me fill in the part that we lost because your phone faded out. But Henry Ford started paying $5 an hour in wages. The prevailing wage was a buck an hour, or a day, rather. And Horace Dodge sued him, and it went all the way to the Michigan Supreme Court. And the argument that Ford put forward in the Supreme Court was that he was actually acting in his own self-interest because now his workers could buy his own cars. And that is a... that's a good story. It's a good story. It's been around for a long time. Jack, thanks for the call and for reminding us all of it. And it did not produce inflation. Instead, it produced consumers. Coming up tomorrow, Friday, and that means brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders will be here talking about all the important issues of the week, taking your calls too, plus anything goes Friday. What's on your mind this week? And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does require your participation. Get out there, occupy something, join up with somebody somewhere, get active, tag your end. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.